Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
Personality, in my opinion, is the byproduct of identity. Identity is how you describe yourself. It's how you see yourself. It's how you explain yourself. The fact that you just said that that was your goal, and I don't know if that truly is your goal, but if it is, the fact that you were open and honest about it, in my opinion, would be very good for your identity if that's what you're actually going for. Because now you're sharing with us who your future self is. And so that would have an impact at the identity level. Identity is, again, how you see yourself. It's based on stories. It's based on how you describe yourself. So if I were to say to you, I'm an introvert, that would actually be more of a statement of my identity than my personality, because I'm describing how I see myself. Now, that may impact my behavior, which may then be reflected as my personality. So your identity shapes your behavior, and your behavior consistently over time is your personality.
Dude, well, like I said, this is a really deep rabbit hole.
It is, dude. It's a great rabbit hole though, right?
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Ben, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Of course. I'm very honored to be on your show. I'm a big fan of you and of this show.
Yeah, thanks. Well, you know, you and I go way back. I think we're both sort of early writers on Medium. And it's kind of funny because I don't think we'd ever met until a few years ago in person. And you have done, you know, what is truly a remarkable job leveraging a platform, you know, coming out of nowhere and really accomplishing something in record time that most people would have said is impossible, all of which we will talk about. But before we get to that, I want to start by asking you what I think is a very relevant question, given the nature of your new book. And that is, what is one of the most important things that you learned from one or both of your parents that have influenced and shaped who you've become and what you've ended up doing with your life?
Yeah, man. I love my parents a lot. And obviously, in the book, I go deep down the rabbit hole of the, you know, I don't go into a lot of the trauma on the side of my mom, but I go into obviously deep aspects of the trauma about my dad being an extreme drug addict from basically when I was age 11 to 20. Thankfully, now he's no longer that guy, and I'm no longer defined by that past. But I've learned a lot from my parents, man. My mom, what I'm continuing to learn is just how much that relationship matters. But you know, for me at least, like the parent relationship really matters. My mom is relentlessly supportive of me. She's always been supportive of me and my younger brothers. So I'm the oldest of three boys. Like I would say that, like, as like an actual parent for a long time, I don't know if I would say like she was like, I guess I'm learning what a good parent actually is, because there actually is no one mold. I think in the past I would have probably said that both of my parents were not the actual best parents, even though they're the best people. But I'm actually reframing that even. I think that they're incredible parents. They really are. Like, they're their own way, you know, and there's no right way to be a parent. My mom is just someone who is endlessly supportive. She'll support you to the moon and back. And she's always done that for me and encouraged me on that. She actually gave me, she had me and my brothers literally watching The Secret, you know, and obviously everyone has their own opinions on that. I even have my own opinions on that, but she had us watching that when I was like 13 years old. Like, I'm not saying that that's what led me to like writing self-improvement stuff. Certainly wasn't, but that's just kind of who she is. My dad, what I've learned from my dad, and he is someone who has had a dark past, but also a lot of light in his past too. He's just a good dude. I mean, I don't really know how better to say it, but he's just a good person. He's a hard worker. My dad, he was an attorney when my parents got divorced, and he even was an attorney afterward, but the divorce led him to an extreme drug addiction. And he's no longer really an attorney, although he does some law work. He works for a company and does more of their financial stuff, but he's just someone who is meticulous. Like, he's just a hard worker, and he just works hard. He does a really good, honest, thorough job. And, you know, I'm impressed by his work ethic, and, you know, he's also super into fitness and health. And so whenever I'm with him, we exercise together and we share that.
Yeah. So when you watch somebody, you know, like a parent who has a severe drug addiction at age 11, What is your understanding of that experience, you know, at that age, and how has it changed over the course of your life? Like, what is that experience? Because as an 11-year-old, you may not even know really what is happening. You just get the sense that something is wrong.
Yeah, it was crazy. My opinions and perspectives on the matter are like changing on a daily basis. But as far as back then, when I was, I was the oldest of three, 11 years old, my parents get divorced. I come from a very religious family. And then when my parents get divorced, religion becomes a non-entity. We don't go to church for years. It's just, and my dad, it was weird to watch because my dad was my hero. He would, and I was the oldest. And so I actually think he invested the most in me. And he's even told me that, like, you know, he would like sit and do homework with me, sit and do math with me. He'd take me to the baseball games, take me to like my soccer games. And like, he did some of that stuff with my younger brother, my middle brother, Trevor, who actually happens to be in a treatment facility right now. But he invested for sure the most in me. And we were just super connected. And so it was, I didn't actually know that the drugs were happening and it got pervasively worse until I was probably 12 or 13. And then like, I knew stuff was happening. Like his behavior became more and more interesting, but at some point he just stopped hiding stuff like as much. Like there was just like pills and powders like on the counters, you know what I mean? And progressively stranger people were at our house regularly. And it just got weirder and weirder. Whereas like, so much so that my friends even could be like, dude, this isn't normal. Like what's going on? And I had friends, I even had friends, cause we would just sit and play video games. Like we skateboarded and played video games. And I did have friends who came from backgrounds with drugs and stuff like that. And they're like, dude, this isn't right. Like there's obviously a lot of stuff going on here. And so it was weird and hard to watch. But like we still stuck it out with my dad as long as we could, like even till I was like 13, 14, you know, like we still were there, even though it was just nuts around us. And eventually I think when I was like 14 or 15 or something like that, stuff just got so bad that we just lived with my mom full time and we just dropped it. But I mean, how I was interpreting it, super hard to say from this vantage point, given that obviously memory changes over time. But I would say, I think I had resentment for my dad back then. I considered him a failed father. That was the interpretation I gave to it, is that my dad failed us. And as a result, my perspective of my life was just that this is life, you know, like we're dealt a bad hand. Like this is just the sad reality. And that this is just like, I just began to have kind of a dark outlook on life, and that life's just not what I thought it was.
Hmm. Why do you think that, you turned out so much differently than your brother did? I mean, you mentioned that your brother is in, you know, treatment facility right now. Like, what do you think was the difference?
There were a lot of differences. One is he was 2 years younger. So he was 9 years old when this was happening. I was 11, you know, and I was the oldest, and I felt, I mean, obviously we do have differences in our characteristics, but he was way more emotionally impacted by the divorce initially, even before the drugs, like the divorce through my brother. Like he actually, you know, he's one of those people who has a lot of natural talent. Like anything he did, he was amazing at, which I actually, as the older brother, slightly resented. Like he was in all the gifted programs. You know, when we started, like when we would play basketball, he was always just like phenomenal. When we started skateboarding, he would like literally at age like 10, he was kickflipping down 9 stairs. Like he was daredevil, charisma. Like all my friends liked him and I was jealous. And so, I think that there's many factors as to why my brother got thrown off. He is more of an emotional person than I am. Whereas like and I suppressed my emotions and I just surrounded myself with friends. And I think because I'm the oldest, like I just feel like I need to like hold strong. Whereas the divorce through my brother, like he started believing he needed glasses, even though he didn't really. So he'd start like, he got prescription glasses, even though like literally he didn't need them. And he just started getting confused, honestly, at age 9. And then I think then the drugs just, got deeper and deeper. And he didn't have kind of some of the foundational support that I had. Like, I had really good friends, even just my grandparents and stuff like that. Like, I was just the oldest grandchild even on that side. And so, I don't know, I just feel like I had a lot more emotional support and friend support than he had. And I think as the middle kid, I think he expected and he definitely needed more support from his oldest brother, like me, who he looked up to. And I kind of shunned him, to be fully honest with you. A lot of it had to do with jealousy. A lot of it had to do with I was just my own confused self. And so I kind of probably caused a lot of his problems, to be fully honest with you.
Mm, wow. So you mentioned that you grew up in this very religious family. And I wonder what impact that had on sort of your worldview, like morality, and how you went about living your life. And, you know, because I feel like religion can fall one of two ways, particularly if you come from an extremely religious family. You know, you basically take the best of it, apply it to your life going forward, or, you know, you go off the rails and basically, you know, shun the whole thing and, you know, go crazy. So, like, what did you take from the experience of growing up, you know, in a religious family and growing up the way you did? I know that you're a father. What impact has that had on you as a parent?
It has a huge impact on me, man. I mean, I openly and admittedly believe in God. And so I kind of had that deeply embedded in me as a young person, like literally like a child, you know? And so that actually, I believe, helped me through my darkest times personally, even though I wouldn't have considered myself religious. Like, let's just say during the dark episodes of like from age 11 to 20 in my childhood, like, I kind of believed God abandoned us or just that we were too far distant from him. I just kind of didn't really think about God that much during that time. Even though my family wasn't that religious, certainly wasn't religious at all during that time period. I would say my father has kind of returned to the faith. My mom, not really. She's more like new age, spiritual, just accepts everyone, really into everything. And so I actually get a lot from both of them. Like, I would consider myself a religious person, but anyone who knows me, like, who's religious or not, would never feel like I'm judgy or pushy or anything. I'm just kind of living what I believe and I let other people do the same. But certainly when I was like, let's just say 19 years old, barely had graduated from high school, was doing nothing with myself, living at my cousin's house, playing World of Warcraft all day, I was living without meaning and I was depressed as a result. And so the place that I naturally went back to for meaning for myself, given my background, was religion. And so ultimately I started going back to church and just by myself and decided, and I can kind of look at it now from a psychological perspective, like I needed a sense of purpose. I needed a goal. I needed a path that I believed could get me somewhere. Otherwise I believed that I would be stuck. And so for me, I just decided to serve a church mission because that was the path that I believed could get me out. You know, my younger brother ended up joining the Marines. For me, my path to a better life or a better situation or some form of possibility ended up being a church mission. And so I ended up doing that at age 20. And it did change my life a lot. As far as what religion does for me now, I mean, it certainly influences my decisions. I mean, I'm a psychologist. I think in terms outside of religion and I'm not dogmatic in how I see things. I believe there's truth in many different forms. I wouldn't just select one, you know?
No.
But it definitely influences my decision-making. I would say I probably wouldn't have 5 kids now if I didn't have the spiritual beliefs. I don't even know if I'd be married, let alone like adopt 3 kids, have 5 kids. Like, I don't think I would have made those choices or oriented my life the way I do. And maybe I wouldn't have even been interested in the topics I'm in if it wasn't for my deeper spiritual beliefs.
Yeah, wow. So you mentioned that you went on a mission for church. Like, this is one thing I always wonder about is when you're on this kind of mission, I'd imagine a good amount of the thing that you're learning is, you know, persuasion, but also persuasion without necessarily being dogmatic about it. So, you know, what did you learn from that period in your life that you've applied going forward?
Yeah, that was... I mean, it was 2 years, you know, just to give some perspective, you know, and this was what we would call like literally, so it was for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. This would be like literally Mormon missionaries. So like they made the musical, you know, the Book of Mormon, like that was literally it, you know, like white shirts, name tags. Like, I mean, it's, and just like, to give some perspective, it's super military-ish almost. Like, you have an extreme schedule. You know, you wake up at 6:30. You've got to be done with like shower and breakfast by 8. You live with another dude, a companion. You always have to have a companion. Like, there's study from 8 to 10. Like, you study, whether it be like training materials or stuff like that, or like scriptures. And then you spend the rest of the day doing like community service and like teaching people. Like, you do a lot of community service and you're just out like pound the pavement and stuff. And you know, you're knocking on, you know, we spend a lot of time literally like helping random people, mowing lawns, like helping people move. We'd go to like elderly places. I mean, we do a lot of that, but we would also straight up go door to door and like knock on the doors and like ask if we could teach people. And, you know, I was in Pennsylvania, I was in Pittsburgh, which is like a really Catholic area. And so 99% of the doors got slammed on our face. And I had no judgment towards that. It actually was interesting, you know, at age 20, in a lot of ways, trying to sell religion, you know, like it can be a scary conversation when like you're still trying to figure it out yourself and you're doing it hundreds of times a day, literally hundreds of doors getting slammed in your face. I mean, there's a lot of research on this now, but like a lot of people from our church who serve these missions become very successful in their careers because you learn how to be resilient. You learn how to get rejected. You know, you learn to do something you believe in, whatever that is. You know, if you're selling cars, you learn to put meaning on things, like almost like an existential meaning. And you learn to like have a sense of purpose. And you also learn to not be afraid getting rejected. I mean, nothing's harder or more personal to try to sell, even though we wouldn't have considered it selling. It kind of was. Than your faith. I mean, if you're doing something less religious, which, you know, because everyone has their own baggage and feelings towards something like that, but you just learn to just handle that stuff. And so I definitely learned that. I mean, that was where I started journaling, as I've mentioned. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was during that 2-year experience that I fell in love with journaling and writing. And I read a ton of books, self-improvement, philosophy, psychology, business, obviously religion. And so I would study the authors, because I had never considered myself a reader or a writer before that time. But I did get into journaling because that was recommended. Just journal about your experiences. You'll want to look back on these one day. And I started journaling in a different form where I would write about my former experiences. I'd write about my experiences, but I learned how to write in a stream of consciousness way where I'd write for literally an hour or two at a time, just with pen and pad. I've got stacks of journals. I still journal because of that experience. But in reading books, my mind just got opened. You know, I'd never really educated myself. I wasn't a student in school, didn't know how to really read. And so I started reading dozens of books on this experience. And, you know, when you start reading a lot, as you know, your brain just starts expanding and changing. And so I was being blown away by all of these factors. And I was studying the writers. And I just decided on that time that I would be a writer one day.
Yeah, it is interesting how, you know, the things that you consume have a way of, you know, shaping and forming your mind. Like, I jokingly say, like, I'm an encyclopedia of all sorts of weird shit because of Unmistakable Creative and the people I've interviewed. Combine that with,
I believe,
you know, a thousand books, and you're kind of like, yeah, you want to know how to rob a bank? I can tell you how to do that. You want to know how to get into the porn industry? I can tell you how to do that now. You know, it's kind of mind boggling how that happens. You know, the thing that really struck me when I first met you, I don't remember where I read it, but I remember somewhere on Medium, you had written a post, which I think is kind of like a perfect segue into the new book, where, you know, somebody had told you about the reality of, you know, becoming a writer. So I want to talk about this in two different ways, in that you basically overcame odds that most people said, you know, were impossible. But I also, part of me is wary of, you know, seeing that as an example, because I think you're an outlier. And I think one of the things that our sort of self-help culture is incredibly guilty of, and you know, Greg Hartle and I have talked about this on air, is that we basically use outliers, you know, like the Oprahs and the Elons and the Steve Jobs of the world as role models. But those people are so far removed from where the average person is at that it often leads to a lot of, you know, more fantasizing than actual progress. And so let's talk about that idea of, you know, you basically looking at the odds and saying, no, I'm going to overcome them. And you did. But also let's talk about this outlier idea.
Yeah, absolutely, man. So do you want me to just like literally say what happened with my writing
career? Yeah. Let's talk about the writing career first, but then I want to come back to this outlier idea, because I know that I have actually referenced some of your posts. It was one, the 8 things before 8 a.m. I said, you know what? You could be reading this and there are things here that you shouldn't do before 8 a.m. If you got up at 2, you know, if you slept at 2 a.m., the only fucking thing you should be doing at 8 a.m. is sleeping.
Totally. Yeah. And I do assume, which I say in that one, and in my morning, my own morning routine changes all the time, but I do assume in that one that people got 7 hours of sleep. Actually, that's right. The first recommendation. So yeah, if you didn't go to bed before, let's just say 9 or 10, then don't do this.
And that's the problem, right? People actually literally treat things as formulas instead of frameworks. So, but let's go back. Tell us about the writing career, and then we'll talk about this whole, you know, outlier thing.
I do love that conversation. I'm excited to see what the heck we mesh and make out of that. So my here's kind of how it went. So I got home from that 2-year mission in around January of 2010. When I was walking home from that experience, I was a totally different person. I came home and I was ready to start going to school. I decided to study psychology and I knew I wanted to be a writer. But at that time, when I just walked home from my mission, I mean, I was so entrenched in my faith and being a missionary that I was thinking that I was going to just be like a religion professor and that I was going to write religious books, kind of like a lot of the ones that influenced me on my mission, even though I'd read like Covey on my mission and stuff. I figured I was going to be a religion professor and I was going to write religious books. But I did want to study psychology. I knew that Covey and others had studied psychology and a lot of, you know, I just was really interested in psychology at that point, not only just because of my own transformation and my own background, but just having met literally thousands of very interesting people on my mission and just seeing, you know, deep into the ghettos and also wealthy people. I don't know. I just was like, okay, I want to understand people. So I studied psychology and didn't really do anything specific to move my writing career forward. So when I got home, it was, you know, 2010. And I would say from 2010 to 2015, I didn't really do much at all. I'd studied psychology and then ultimately got into a PhD program in organizational psychology. And so me and my wife moved to Clemson, South Carolina, where I did my PhD. And through those 4 or 5 years, I had studied a ton of just self-improvement. You know, I was studying a ton of like business books and ultimately learning a lot more, let's just say, about the book world at large. And I would say in late 2014, I started reading stuff from like, let's just say, Jeff Goins, Seth Godin, Michael Hyatt, Ryan Holiday, like the types of people who are like kind of openly talking about how to become a writer and stuff like that. Like that's when I was like starting to really think about it. I don't think I had the bandwidth to truly think about the how before that, because I was so busy trying to get through school and trying to get into a PhD program. And honestly, the reason I got the PhD in many ways was twofold. One was, you know, in my faith, formal education is actually heavily pushed, even though I know firsthand the problems of formal education. You know what I mean? And so I kind of, you know, my leader on my mission president told me to get as much education as I could. And so I kind of felt inspired to go get a lot of formal education, even though while going through it, I saw a lot of its contradictions and weaknesses, and I still do. And I don't recommend most people to do what I did. But once I'd gotten into my PhD program, I felt like that major hurdle was done. And I started that in August of 2014. That's when I was like, okay, now I feel finally ready where I can start learning about this book thing. And by then, I kind of had shifted directions where I was obviously not going to be a religion professor. I was more interested in psychology and like leadership and business. I'd read tons of books by that point in business and self-improvement, creativity and stuff like that. And so I was more leaning towards the Ryan Holidays and just like, you know, and Covey still influenced me, but I was like, okay, I'm going to write more on this general self-improvement stuff. And so that was kind of when I started studying it. In 2015, in the early period of 2015, and by this point, I'm reading lots of Godin. You know what I mean? I read The Icarus Deception, Tribes, Purple Cow. I mean, I was starting to really dig into this stuff and really like try to figure it out. I decided I wanted to be an author, but I didn't actually want to be a blogger. I just wanted to somehow go straight to writing books. but it became very apparent. I started calling agents and, you know, telling them I wanted to be a writer. And I started like messaging people like Jeff and others, Jeff Goins and others, and just asking them how to become an author. Like, I'm like, how do I get a book contract? How do I start working with a publisher? Like, you know, I'm like, you know, in my mind, I had a lot of kind of bottled tension. Like, I had gone on that mission. I'd obviously had my extreme childhood and like I'd, you know, been studying psychology and just had a great desire to communicate and to share. And so I just figured you could just start, you know, wherever you wanted to go. But, you know, through multiple conversations, it became obvious that like I actually needed to start at the bottom and start blogging. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
you have to actually build an audience, Ben. You can't write a book. I mean, you could go write a self-published book if you want. And I did do that. But they're like, you need to build an audience. You've got to start blogging and writing online and actually getting people who care about your work before you can get that book deal. And so I ultimately, you know, asked lots and lots of questions in the beginning. You know, how do you get a book deal? I asked Jeff. Jeff told me multiple levels of like, he's like, you know, if you have 10,000 email subscribers, you can probably get like a $20,000 or $30,000 book deal. If you have 100,000 email subscribers, you might be able to get, you know, $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000 book deal. And so I just was getting this level of information just in the beginning, just information download, and ultimately kind of set the quest for myself to get 100,000 emails and to try to get a 6-figure book deal. So that was kind of the mindset I had from the beginning. You know, this was just me exploring. And so ultimately what I ended up doing was buying John Morrow's guest blogger course, which, you know, is like $197. Bought my domain name in early 2015, BenjaminHari.com. And then that's when I just started learning how to write viral stuff. And, you know, then I just, you know, and my story is a little bit outlierish because there's so many aspects of it that wouldn't work for everyone. And I'm not even sure why they worked for me. But basically, I started blogging probably in like April or May of 2015. And literally in June of 2015, that article, 8 Things Every Person Should Do Before 8 a.m., got read by like 3 million people within like 3 days, you know, like, I mean, I was doing headlines galore off of what John Morrow was teaching. I mean, I probably between May and June that, you know, of 2015, I probably wrote 20 or 30 articles. I was pitching them all over the place, writing on like very like low level plate, you know, like just any blog that would accept them. And ultimately, you know, I started throwing stuff on medium.com, and that article, for some reason or another, just smashed it. And then it got picked up immediately by Huffington Post and Business Insider and other places. And I got a Huffington Post blog. And, you know, ultimately I just kept cranking it for several years on that platform. I learned how to turn it into email subscribers. I read Russell Brunson's book, taught me how to like build landing pages. I read his .com secrets book in 2016, and I ultimately learned how to turn it into about 20,000 emails a month. So for over 2.5 years, I was getting 20,000 email subscribers a month without any paid advertising. So from 2015 to 2018, late into 2018, I went from zero to like 400,000 email subscribers just through medium.com. And it was just, I mean, obviously there's a lot within that, but it was a crazy journey. I got the first book deal in 2017 in January. That became Willpower Doesn't Work. I asked Ryan Holiday for help. I paid him $3,000 and he helped me write the book proposal. He helped me get my first agent. And I got the book deal for Willpower Doesn't Work literally a year and a half after I started writing.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah. So, I think this is the part that really I find interesting, right? Is that like, I'm the polar opposite of your story, right? I spent 10 years and like, mine is absolutely a Cinderella story. Like an editor at Penguin stumbled on something that I happened to write on Medium. Now, keep in mind, I did the work. Like I spent, you know, all that time, you know, actually in the process. And I think that the sort of temptation that we have, you know, I've seen in a lot of people is they'll hear a story like yours and they'll be like, okay, how do I reverse engineer that? And this is the big thing I always say, like, this is the one variable that throws off every so-called formula for success. And that's you, you know,
like, it's true.
And that,
you
that
can't
is
have
somehow,
all of my background and whatnot, right?
Well, that's somehow not taken into account when people consume, you know, personal development content, like they ignore context. And I think
that's why we
end up with this sort of outlier problem. Like the temptation would be for somebody to like, oh, okay, cool. Write on Medium, you know, talk to Jeff Goins, you know, call a bunch of agents and do exactly what Ben says. In a year and a half, I'll have, you know, a 6-figure book contract. Like, you know, I mean, and the funny thing is like, you know, it's interesting because despite having, you know, like a list that was nowhere as near as big, but you know, self-publishing, I ended up with a pretty, you know, lucrative book contract. But I don't have any of the factors that you do. Like that's probably why you have a second book deal. But at the same time, the outlier problem is the one that I think is really pervasive in this world of personal development. And I think it really is sort of this beautiful segue into talking about this whole idea that personality is impermanent, because what I recently finished reading this book titled How the Relentless Pursuit of Positive Thinking is Undermining America. And you hear that and you might think, God, that's a pessimistic view. And at the same time, personal development, I think, encourages a lot of delusional optimism, mainly because people don't consider context. They're like, oh, I'll just do what this person did. And it's like, the thing is that now you go to Medium, right? If somebody started Medium today, first off, there's thousands of people. And it's a
literally
kind of like
tens of thousands now. Hundreds of thousands, probably.
Yeah, I mean, I don't get anywhere near the same mileage I used to from it. But to me, the value of having done that was I learned how to develop a process for my ideas, which is far more valuable than the outcome itself. But yeah, I mean, I kind of, as somebody who writes about this stuff, as somebody who has a degree in psychology, organizational psychology, and who just wrote a book called Personality is Impermanent, what is your view on my criticism of all of this?
I think that your criticism is merited. I think that context matters way more than Western thinkers give it credit for. That's one of the things that I tried to point out in both of these books, actually. Willpower Doesn't Work being fundamentally about how context is more important than willpower. And that in our culture, we think you can grit your way there without actually understanding that the context matters more. So that definitely was the fundamental idea of that book. With this book, I slam a lot of the personality tests as an example because those tests fundamentally ignore context. You get a score on a test and you assume that that's who you always are versus in different contexts, you're going to be different. And so I definitely couldn't agree more that context matters greatly. I'm also a big believer that context can be shaped. Obviously, that was a big aspect of Willpower Doesn't Work. Ellen Langer is one of my favorite psychologists. She wrote a book called Mindfulness and a book called Counterclockwise. She's been at Harvard for a long, long time. I don't even know if she's still there. She was one of Adam Grant's mentors. But her books and her work, to me, it very much deeply influences my thinking. And she's been studying mindfulness before it became trendy, and all of her stuff is based on context. And really, most social psychologists view context as king, that you can't understand someone without first understanding their context. You can't understand how they're acting without understanding their context. And so, this idea is really important for a lot of different reasons, because it forces us to not be judgmental of other people. Like as an example, when I was 11 years old, I didn't understand my father's context. I didn't know why he became a drug addict, and I couldn't have come to understand his context at that time. I could have tried, but I wasn't emotionally or intellectually capable. I became in survival mode given just my situation, and also he might not have been in a place. But context shapes the meaning of content, and that's true of content itself, like information, but it's also true of people. So as an example, during COVID-19, when it first started, I used the word viral in one of my articles. I said, look, this new article is going viral or something like that. And this was right when it was first hitting, in March or April, and people were heavily sensitive. And I don't blame them for that at all. But people, I got probably 30 or 40 emails that just said, Ben, will you please not use the word viral right now? It's not really appropriate right now. And I said, no worries. And so I didn't do it. Had I said that word, like a month before COVID hit, no one would have been triggered by it. No one would have even thought about it because the context shaped the meaning of that word. And so obviously a fundamental aspect of reframing is about, or choosing a better meaning, meanings being the ultimate, in my opinion. I think everything's about the meaning you give to things. Life is all about meaning more than anything. In order to produce a meaning, you have to have a context. And when you change the context, you change the meaning. And so kind of pulling all of these, ideas back to your question, I think the hard part is providing that context in a consumable way Because I understand that everyone has a different context, and part of providing information is giving people information that they can use. But there's a fundamental problem in that you don't know the reader's context. You don't know where they're coming from. You know, you're doing your best to give them information that they can use to hopefully change their context. But yeah, there is a flaw to the idea, you know, and this is what a lot of psychologists would be angry about with self-help information, is mm-hmm. that information about context isn't given. Not only not given about the writer or about like what contexts are needed for this information to be useful, but also a respect to the reader's context in the fact that how much can they truly apply this given their context? You know, a lot of that stuff is not accounted for in this type of information.
No. Wow. Well, speaking of which, let's talk about this whole idea that personality isn't permanent. How did you arrive at this conclusion? Like what made you want to do this as the next book after Willpower Doesn't Work?
Yeah. It was certainly not necessarily the topic that I was thinking I was going to go after. So a lot of what inspired Willpower Doesn't Work was obviously my background in addiction, father being a drug addict, brother being a drug addict. I've had my own issues with addiction. And so I look at personal growth, a lot of it from the standpoint of how would you overcome an addiction? You know, although I have a big background in psychology and even like, you know, my background in psychology is more like leadership and training and stuff like that. It's more the business side, even though like I've studied very much deeply the therapy side. Mm-hmm. And just with my background in addiction, you know, a lot of people who are in the addiction worlds love my books. They love Willpower Doesn't Work. They love Personality Improvement because I kind of speak their language just because I've been so deep in that world. And so I am always interested in addiction. And I was told to read the book, The Body Keeps the Score, from Joe mm-hmm. Polish, who's yeah. Joe is very deep in the addiction world. He's had many addictions and he's very open about all of them. And so I read the book, The Body Keeps the Score, with an interest in studying addiction and just how trauma, is one of the major reasons why people would even go into an addiction is unresolved emotional trauma. But the thing that really hit me and where my mind was at when I was listening to that book was how much trauma shaped personality. For some reason, uh-huh. that just really was hitting me hard at the time I was listening to that book. And it was probably in summer of 2018. Willpower Doesn't Work came out in March of 2018. And, at that point, we had adopted our three kids. My wife was pregnant with twins. So this was 2018. We now had three kids and two on the way. And like, I was going through a lot myself. My own world was becoming a lot more complex. And so my thinking was becoming more complex, less simplistic, less just easy answers. And that book really hit me. And I began thinking a lot about personality and about what personality is and what people have wrong about personality. And I thought it was a big enough subject that I could hit the deeper notes as far as what changes, how it works, why people get stuck. Because I was already a believer in change. You know, I felt like I had gone through a lot of change before my mission and even way after. And I believe I'm still going through a lot of change. And I felt like having gone through a PhD in psychology, there was even a lot of confusion on the subject of personality within psychologists. You know, like I had a friend who was a professor at Clemson who believed personality was the be all end all and that it can't change and that you're born who you are. He obviously also had Christian beliefs that were influencing his background. And most psychologists generally are actually not that religious, to be honest with you. It's a pretty atheistic field. But I just thought, I didn't think personality was permanent anyways. And now I have this amazing book telling me that trauma freezes personality and keeps you stuck in repetitive cycles. I'd been told throughout my PhD by every one of my professors that personality tests like Myers-Briggs and those any type-based tests are just junk science. I mean, I'd been told that by every one of my professors. And those things are obviously so popular. And so there was just so many conflicting concepts around this subject of personality. I just felt like it was the right topic to dive into, to teach really cool ideas, obviously on overcoming trauma, on making rapid change. It just felt like the right topic that I could like build a mind map around, as you and I would think of it, and just say like, this is the vehicle through which I'm going to teach some of these really cool, important ideas.
Well, it's funny you mention that because I'm literally looking at the mind map I have of your book as we speak. So let's get into it too. You know, I think what you call the myths of personality, and then we'll talk about the truth of personality. I mean, you say that, you know, that the myths are that it can be categorized, which you know, references personality tests, which is interesting because we make so many decisions, like, you know, all the way up through the corporate world. Like the corporate world uses Myers-Briggs as some sort of like litmus test for what is a person going to be good at, which I think that, you know, it takes us to that idea that, you know, it's innate and fixed. It's something you discover. I think the one that I, you know, those myths, like one, you know, can you expand on them? But the one that struck me in particular that I thought was, I was kind of like, really? It's the one you said about, you know, who you authentically are. I think most people, when they hear that, are like, wait a minute, what do you mean? Who I'm authentically am isn't my personality.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, personality and comfort zone are very similar concepts. Essentially, to do anything outside your comfort zone would probably be doing something outside your typical personality, unless that just has become your personality to be someone who's constantly going out of your comfort zone. But if you're that way, you're probably changing a lot. You know, like I was one of the things that I learned on my mission, actually, because I had to go out of my comfort zone 1,000 times a day by like knocking on a door, and it was always nerve-wracking, you know, like to knock on a door and to like have someone maybe angry answer in us, and then to try to figure out how we could, you know, persuade them, as you would say, or to get them interested. Like that being outside the comfort zone regularly was to me where I started to become what I would call more flexible and adaptive and also more confident as a person. So anyways, going back to the idea of authenticity, a lot of people think that a lot of people, they view personality and they when they think of personality, they think of the word tendency. They think of the word natural ability. They think of the thing like strengths and weaknesses. They think like at the core, there's got to be something about this person that doesn't change. You know what I mean? Like, and obviously we all do have uniqueness about us, and we all do have tendencies and things like that. Not to say that those are hardwired or can't be changed, but when people think of the word authentic, what they're, you know, at least in maybe a millennial term, you know, obviously there's many different ways of describing authenticity, but generally, you know, when you're like, you know, be your true authentic self, live your truth, stuff like that, you're thinking like, do what feels right or most natural to you, and don't do what doesn't feel right. And that can then lead to a similar conversation of, well, only do your strengths. Only do those things that come natural. Avoid your weaknesses. You know, you hear people like Gary Vee say, just go all in on your strengths and ignore your weaknesses. That's a very, I would say, like, I wouldn't agree with that. Even though, like, I very much believe in going with strengths, like, and like, but I'm also like, as I, like, I, when I became a foster parent of 3 kids, and I tell this story in the book, but it did not feel good at all. It didn't feel authentic. It didn't feel natural. It didn't feel normal. It didn't feel easy. In many ways, I didn't really want to do it. Like it was during the first year of my PhD program, and I avoided coming home for the first year from school because first off, the house became a chaotic mess. Their behavior was nuts. You know, like the first year, they had a lot of emotional baggage for completely understandable reasons. And I wasn't as capable as I am now as being empathetic towards them. I was kind of like, freak. I mean, I wasn't ready. I hadn't adapted nor identified as a parent. You know what I mean? And so I was just like, what the freak? And I think that right there, like even my two twins now, we've got 18-month-old twins. You know, we live down in Florida. A lot of people have swimming pools here in Florida. And we have to put our kids through swimming lessons. A lot of kids go through swimming lessons literally like sometimes before they can even walk here. Just because the last thing you want to do is go to the backyard and find a drowning child, which unfortunately and sadly has been the experience of many people, or a drowned baby. You don't want that. And so with like 4 or 5 months ago, we started our twin girls into swimming lessons, and you know, let's just say their authentic selves wouldn't have wanted to do that. They hated it. They were crying. They were upset about it, you know, and it took months for them to adapt and to learn, you know, I would say engaging in deliberate practice with the help of a coach. Now they love it. Now they jump in the pool. They're happy. And so I guess my view of authenticity is that it is often an excuse for not doing anything difficult, you know, for only doing what immediately feels good. And that's what Simon Sinek would say too, is he's called a lot of millennials out. I'm obviously a millennial, but he, you know, there's been a lot of debate about millennials in the workforce because they're not willing to, you know, as Cal Newport would say, develop rare and valuable skills. Instead, they want immediate gratification for work that they're immediately passionate about. Mm-hmm. And that mindset doesn't really work for me if you're someone who wants to develop something useful. And so my, you know, I think most people's perspective of personality, you know, it being innate, it being natural, is that you should then find what's immediately passionate, immediately natural. And if there's not, and so it's based on pain and pleasure. It's based on if it's painful, don't do it. If it's pleasurable, do it. It's based on immediate gratification and emotion. And so that's kind of the mindset that I would want to pull people away from, is that authenticity can be a distraction from actually choosing something that would transform you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk about the what you call the truth of personality. You basically, you know, break it up into a couple of different categories, which, you know, these are the ones that I want to get to. Your goals shape your identity. You talk about the sources of all the goals and how your identity should intentionally be designed based on your future self. So I'm going to do something completely selfish here, and I'm going to use a goal, one of my own goals, and want you to walk me through it with, you know, the framework of my own goals. So let's say that I have a goal to, for example, you know, have a million people listening to Unmistakable Creative. Let's start there.
Which I would love that goal. Yeah, I mean, me too. I mean, dude.
Okay, so let's talk about how that would shape identity.
Yes, absolutely. So it's great that we're talking about identity, because obviously identity and personality are different subjects. This book's called Personality is Impermanent, but now we're talking about identity. And identity, in my opinion, actually is fundamentally way more important. Personality, in my opinion, is the byproduct of identity. And so identity is how you describe yourself. It's how you see yourself. It's how you explain yourself. The fact that you just said that that was your goal, and I don't know if that truly is your goal, but if it is, the fact that you were open and honest about it, in my opinion, would be very good for your identity, if that's what you're actually going for. Because now you're sharing with us who your future self is. And so that would have an impact at the identity level. So I guess let me just break this down really simply, and then we'll cover your goal. But identity is, again, how you see yourself. It's based on stories. It's based on how you describe yourself. So if I were to say to you, I'm an introvert, that would actually be more of a statement of my identity than my personality, because I'm describing how I see myself. Yeah. Now that may impact my behavior, which may then be reflected as my personality. So your identity shapes your behavior, and your behavior consistently over time is your personality. And most people's identity is based in the present. So if you were like most people, Srini, you'd just be saying, this is where Unmistakable Creative is right now. Yeah. But identity truly can and should be based on goals. And so I guess here's how I would break it down for you. If you really wanted to have this podcast reach millions of people, I would quantify that a little further. Like, is that monthly? Mm-hmm. Is that annually? But then I would also define out, before you even hit that goal, who future you is. You know what I mean? Who's your future self? You know, like that's where a lot of the cool research in psychology has gone, in my opinion, is, you know, your identity isn't actually that goal. That goal is the way you achieve your future identity. And so future you, what does that actually look like? I mean, are you the exact same guy you are right now? Or are you doing things at a different level? Like, what is your lifestyle different? Is your money different? Is your ability to communicate different? How are you impacting people differently? Like, what does your life look like in 2 to 3 years? Let's assume that you've achieved that goal in 3 years from now. Mm-hmm. Who are you then? Like, that's actually where you would actually start. Because that's then where you would allow yourself to frame an identity around that future self.
So it's funny you say that. There's something that I learned this, concept of environment. I mean, obviously you wrote about that and willpower doesn't work. And I learned about it from a guy named Jim Bunch and, my friend Charmaine, once I was telling her, I said, if I had $1 million recording studio, I would hang frame prints of the people I've interviewed on my wall. And she looked at me and she said, honey, you don't need $1 million recording studio for that. You need some IKEA frames and a willingness to print those damn covers. And so it's funny because I have, covers of, four or five people that I've interviewed behind me on the wall in my office. But as I was talking to my roommates the other day, like we'd reached out to Trevor Noah's team, and they turned us down. And I thought about changing them. I was like, what if I replaced all those album covers, not with people who I have interviewed, but with people I want to eventually interview?
That would be brilliant. That would be a very future self-oriented environment design.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
That'd be really smart.
And that's a really simple one, it's kind of,
That example. Like if I would have known that example, I probably would have thrown that one in the book. Cause I like that example better than the one I gave in my book. Like I love that example. It makes a lot of sense.
It occurred to me the other day and I was like, my room was like, yeah, that's genius. You should absolutely do that. But there's one other part of this. Now, Ryan, I know, Ryan's work really well. Now, Ryan had said something to me that always stayed with me about the fact that he never talks about a book until it's finished. And that, one of the things that happens when you make public announcements of these grand gestures is you get all this praise for something you haven't done yet. And it actually demotivates you in a lot of ways. And I've seen this happen. Like people make grand gestures on Facebook all day long. And I'm like, listen, nobody gives a shit what you're going to start. All they care about is what you finish.
Mm-hmm.
So there's sort of a balancing act. I mean, you're not saying to make bold proclamations in public that never come true. Cause I think
I have to say, I don't agree with Ryan in that case.
Okay. Interesting.
I actually heard from Seth Godin that you should be marketing a book 3 years before it comes out.
Right.
And so,
Ryan is doing that. He's just not talking about the fact that, he's writing a book. Cause there are a lot of people who go and talk about writing a book they keep mentioning the book they're going to write.
You've seen this. There's way more steps than just doing the telling, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I would say of the many, many people who are telling you that they want to write a book, there's 10x more who aren't telling you what they really want to do.
Yeah.
People often hold their true dreams to their chest. Yeah. It's easy to be a dreamer who is only that, who is all talk, no walk. But mm-hmm. I would say that's actually less of a problem than people not openly and honestly admitting what they really want to do out of fear of rejection or, because if you actually say, this is what I want to do, then to some degree, you're slightly accountable to what you just said, unless you want to make yourself a liar or you want to make yourself into someone who's, you're that guy who's told us for 5 years you're going to do this, but haven't done it. Most mm-hmm. people don't want to put themselves in that position. So as a result, they don't openly acknowledge and admit what they truly want. Mm-hmm. Also, obviously, most of those people who would say, I want to write a book but never do, don't engage in, the type of strategies or practices recommended to actually build confidence, to build that identity, to upgrade, your environment and subconscious. Like they're not actually doing anything beyond just saying that's what they want to do. Uh-huh. And so it never actually solidifies as a part of their new identity because it's never actually reflected in their behavior beyond just saying it.
So we talked a little bit about, sort of looking at environment. And I know that, environment is one of those really powerful forces, but you also talk about the sources of goals, which are exposure, desire, and confidence. Can you expand on that and talk, beyond environment, how you think about this idea of designing your identity for your future self?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So... exposure. So basically, I make the argument in the book, and there's a theory in philosophy. I'll tell a quick story to kind of explain this, and then I'll break down kind of how we choose the goals we do. Because from my perspective, the goals we choose are the things shaping our identity. But a lot of people aren't really that conscious of their goal. Instead, they just think that that's what they do. So the story is the one I actually do tell in the book. It's Andre Norman. I'll break it down really shortly. But Andre is someone I know. He's actually someone who I think would be a freaking amazing guest on this show. But he's the guy who basically grew up in the hood of Boston and ultimately ended up in prison and then ultimately ended up becoming a fellow at Harvard. But what ultimately happened for Andre is he had a teacher who actually cared about him. You know, this Black kid, his teachers mostly probably segregated against him, probably thought nothing about him because he came from a crappy situation and just thought there was nothing to invest in him. One teacher, Miss Ellis, his band teacher, actually cared about him, saw him as a human being rather than just as whatever. So she got him interested in the band. She got him interested in trumpet. And ultimately, he got interested probably because she cared about him. And so he felt some probably positive affinity towards her. And so he actually liked going to her class. And that really had some deep meaning to him, which then obviously that meaning became part of why he fell in love with the trumpet. And so for a few years, he really fell in love with the trumpet. It became part of who he was and part of what he aspired towards. And ultimately, when he ended up going to junior high, his friends, his junior high friends told him that he couldn't carry the trumpet around because they thought it was stupid looking. And so he ended up throwing the trumpet away. And once he did that, he no longer had any reason to go to school. Because from what he said, and he's told this to me and my kids in our living room, his purpose was gone. The trumpet was his purpose. And once the purpose was gone, the behavior stopped. It would have taken an extreme willpower. It wouldn't have made logical sense. And so his purpose shifted to really being cool with his friends. And obviously they were criminals and stuff like that. So that landed him over time into prison by age 18. And the point of all of this is that whatever purpose you have, whatever you're actually seeking, that's the thing shaping your identity. That's why I say your goal shapes your identity. Ultimately, his goals kept shifting over time. And I kind of just try to use his story to prove that fact. He gets into prison. He learns of the drug hierarchy and stuff like that. He ends up seeking to be one of the number one thugs in prison. It lands him in solitary confinement for a few years. And ultimately, his quest is to be the top dog in prison. And once he's got the shot to do it, is all he's got to do is kill a few guys, and then he's unquestionably number one. He finally questions the validity of his goal. You know, like it hit him in the face, as he calls it, his Wizard of Oz moment, where he realizes that maybe at the end of this yellow brick road, there's actually nothing there. It only hit him because he was finally like about to achieve it, and he was able to question, why am I building my whole life around this target? Because whatever target you're pursuing, that is your identity. He ended up shifting his target to getting into Harvard because that was the only school he'd ever heard of. And from his exposure, his belief, going to college was his way of staying out of prison and becoming a successful person. And so he made Harvard his new trumpet or his new purpose. And that then gave him a new identity to work towards. So the only reason I share all that is... I call to question every one of your listeners right now and ask you to genuinely consider what the heck you're actually pursuing. Because whatever it is you're actually pursuing, and you may not even be aware of it, it may be acceptance from friends. It may be going through college. You know, for a long time, that was my identity, was getting through college. For a long time, it was being the number one writer on Medium. You know, now it's quite different. Now it's, I want to freaking be a great dad. You know what I mean? And stuff like that. And so what is it you're actually pursuing and pouring energy into? That's the thing shaping your identity. And your identity is shaping your behavior. And your behavior over time is shaping your personality. That's how it works. Wow. And so the question then becomes, well, where do these goals actually come from? And that's the three things I break down, which are exposure, desire, and confidence. Exposure just being you wouldn't actually pursue something you're not aware of. That brings into concept of context. If you're not aware of something, you're probably not going to pursue it. And so obviously you would want to be someone who's expanding your context regularly so that you can be more aware of more things because, you know, you're limited by what you're aware of. And that's actually internally and externally, you know, but in this case, more just speaking about external, like becoming aware of more options. You know, our foster kids, and even still, they're kids, you know, but like they were aware of very little when we got them because they'd grown up literally in a trailer in the middle of the country, in the middle of nowhere in South Carolina. You know, like Clemson, where I went to school, is in the middle of nowhere. There's actually a lot of debate about it right now because it's literally on what used to be a slave plantation. But they had no awareness of much, and they still don't, given that they're kids. But when we first got them, You know, we traveled all over the place. I think we've probably taken them to 40 of the United States just to show them stuff. You know, they've listened to tons of audiobooks. Like, we're trying to just show our kids more and more. But you can't pursue or you can't go after something you're not aware of. And so you can see this in what people pursue. You know, like little kids, they go after what their parents want because that's all they're exposed to. You know, as you grow up, you start to get exposed to what your friends want. So you start chasing what your friends have or what they want or what they tell you is right. And so over time, as you grow up, the goal, and this is why I do like Ryan's work, I like your work, I like the idea of education and learning, is that in order to actually pursue meaningful goals, or at least thought out or informed goals, you need to be educating the heck out of yourself. And hopefully the goals you're pursuing now are more informed than the goals you were pursuing 5 years ago, because hopefully you're a different person than you were 5 years ago and that you've been exposed to a lot more. And so you're seeking hopefully better aims than you did, better than you could have even imagined a few years ago, just simply by your own ignorance. And that same concept moves forward towards your future self. If you think that who you are right now is the be-all end-all, then you're assuming that your future self has the exact same information that you have right now, which is, in my opinion, a pretty bad perspective. It also then forces you to be humble about your current perspective, because right now you're incredibly limited by what you currently know. And in the future, you're going to know much, hopefully you're going to have much better information, better context. And so, in fact, I already know that that's going to happen for all people, because that's what the research shows. All people are going to change over time, whether they're intentional about it or not. Your future self isn't going to be who you are. But if you're actually constantly growing and expanding and getting more exposure and information, then your future self will be pursuing better, more informed goals than you are right now. Therefore, they will have a different identity. Therefore, over time, they will have a different personality. So that's the one. I don't know if you want me to go deeper into desire and confidence, but
Let's actually go into, you know, like, I'm realizing how deep this is now. Like, you and I would have to talk for 3 hours to cover, you know, how much you've put into this.
I mean, I don't even know if we'd cover the whole book.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, even just looking at the mind map as you're explaining each one of these things, you know, I think we've kind of, you know, talked a bit about trauma through stories, but I think what I want to really get, you know, is a sense for this idea of changing stories. But one of the things that, you know, in terms of shifting stories that really struck me was how you talked about emotional regulation, because I think that, you know, and particularly right now in this moment in history,
it's big.
What I can tell you is that, you know, I think people feel panic, they feel fear, they feel anxiety, they feel uncertainty, and as a result, many of them, I think, are paralyzed. And so, you know, I know this because I was writing about this, you know, for our final, you know, newsletter for the you know, Prime launch that we're doing, about how there, you know, if you look at sort of times in history, Ryan Holiday wrote about this in his book where he said, you know, some of the greatest companies have been built in the midst of a recession. And I realized, like, you know, I graduated business school with no job, like, you know, I was spiritually, emotionally, and financially bankrupt. Like, nobody has a vision that that's what their life is going to look like at age 30. And yet, had it not been for that, there would be no unmistakable creative today. I wouldn't be having this conversation with you. But, you know, I don't think I was aware enough to know that I had a positive emotional reaction to that. So let's talk about this idea of emotional regulation.
Mm-hmm. It's huge, man. So I guess just to break down the basics of emotions, emotions are fundamental to human beings. We're far more emotional than logical. We make decisions for emotional reasons, and learning to harness your emotions, learning how to not be manipulated by your emotions, I guess you could say, or governed by your emotions is crucial. And so emotional regulation is about choosing. It's kind of like the idea of react versus respond, you know? So like when you have an experience, you're going to have an emotion. If you get cut off on the road, you might feel a little bit of panic or frustration or anger. You know what I mean? You're going to have an initial response. Emotional regulation is about being aware of your reaction and proactively deciding what to do with that. Rather than acting on your initial reaction, it's about taking a step back and thinking to yourself, what meaning do I want to give to this experience? And how do I want to feel? And what do I want to do about this? And that's essentially emotional regulation. It's about emotional development as a human being. And the more you can do that in increasingly difficult experiences, you know, getting cut off on the road, I think a lot of us can handle reframing our initial reaction and getting over it and moving forward. One of the things that's connected to this, which I talk about in the book, is the idea of refractory period. And the refractory period is the amount of time it takes to emotionally recover from an experience. And for something as small as getting cut off on the road, hopefully the refractory period is instantaneous or within a minute or two. Hopefully it doesn't throw off your entire day, right? Yeah. But obviously we do have experiences that throw us off emotionally, and they can throw us off emotionally for hours or days or weeks or years. You know, that being trauma of some sort, where you do get thrown off and you're still impacted by what happened years ago. And so emotional regulation is really about choosing the frame that you give to an experience and choosing the meaning you give to the experience and choosing then therefore how you feel about it. And so this is why, you know, you want to get really good at this as a skill, because if someone cuts you off, your initial reaction is based on your feelings. And if your feelings are frustration or anger towards that person, then you're going to create really bad meanings in that situation. The meaning might be, I hate this guy, or that person is a terrible driver. Like, you could come up with all sorts of meanings, which are going to impact how you feel and how you see the world, and also how you see that situation. You're going to create a really, let's just say, limiting context. And usually it's going to be heavily judgmental towards the other person. It's going to ignore context. You know what I mean? Whereas if you step back, you can take a different look. You can proactively think about it from a different angle. You know, maybe this guy's in a hurry. You know, maybe let's give this guy the benefit of the doubt. Maybe, who knows what's happening? We don't know the situation. You know, it's about choosing the context so that you can choose the meaning. And this skill, there's obviously systematic steps. Obviously, if you're in the car, you can't sit and pull out your journal. You know what I mean? This is just you thinking in, like, you know, if there's someone near you having a conversation. If not, you can do this in your head. Ultimately, choosing a better meaning for the situation, so that, because the meaning you give is going to ultimately shape your emotions. And meaning making is fundamental to identity. It's fundamental to how we feel. And what's great with emotional regulation is the better you get at it, the more emotionally flexible you become, where you're not immediately consumed by your emotions and you're not driven by your initial reactions. As you get better at emotional regulation, you become more flexible emotionally, where you can sit with those emotions and you can still move forward in an intentional, healthy way, rather than having the emotions totally derail you. And obviously, if you're pursuing big goals, or if you're just doing a lot of challenging stuff, it could be parenting, it could be running a business, you need to become emotionally flexible so that you can actually handle the crazy ups and downs. Even if you're just trying to deal with life in the midst of COVID-19, all sorts of world changes, you need to become more adaptable, which requires that you become better at handling your emotions. And a great part about this process is that you get to do it towards not only things you're handling in the present, but things you've handled in the past. Like we've already talked about lots in this conversation, we've all had crazy things that have happened in our past. And the former versions of ourselves gave meaning to our former experiences, whether good or bad, based on our context, based on where we were at emotionally in our development. We did give meanings to our experiences in the past. The cool part about memory and the cool part about just the past is that time, from a psychological standpoint, is nonlinear. It's not, you know, obviously the actual sequence of events, you can't go back, but from an emotional and from a psychological perspective, you actually very much can. You can go back and you can reframe the meanings of former experiences by looking at the context differently now. And actually, that's what we do all the time. Like right now, obviously, with all the racial stuff going on in the country, we're now looking at former aspects of history differently. We're now looking at Colin Kaepernick with praise, whereas maybe 4 years ago, we were looking at him with anger. I'm not saying everyone was, but like a lot of people's opinions towards form, this always happens. This is how history works. With new data, with new context, we reshape the meaning of the past all the dang time. And so we can do that on an individual level as well. And we do that with ourselves, but with some events, particularly the negative traumas, particularly some of the things that really have impacted our identity, we tend to disconnect those from the rest of the context of ourselves. They say you decontextualize trauma. You disconnect it from everything else, and that's why it doesn't get integrated in with new experiences. And so that's why it can take a lot of emotional pain sometimes to actually face old traumas, because you kind of have to reconjure the meanings that you had formerly given to those experiences. You've got to re-go back to some of those painful emotions. And that's why journaling about former experiences is so recommended in therapy. It's recommended to journal and ultimately to talk about your former experiences so that you can then get them out. Viktor Frankl said that emotions cease to be suffering once you give them a clear picture. So you give it a picture, you give it a context, you give it a story. You say, this is where I was at. This is how I felt. This is how it impacted me. However, I don't really feel that way anymore because I can now see things from a different perspective. I'm no longer choosing to see it that way. I'm no longer choosing to see my dad being a drug addict as something that was bad for me. Actually, I'm choosing to believe it actually was really good for me. And that had I not gone through those experiences, I probably wouldn't have had such a powerful mission that I had. You know, like, you get to choose the lens. I don't have, like, what I just said is not objective fact. It actually objectively wasn't good for me. It was chosen to be good for me because I got to choose the story, and meaning and stories go together. Whatever meaning you give to an event, that's now the story. And your story is your identity. And that identity is what shapes your behavior. So it's just crucially important on an emotional level for us to choose better meanings for the past and the present and ultimately the future.
Hmm. Wow. So the final thing I want to talk about, and you know, I want to kind of go about it in a different way. You know, you talk a lot about the subconscious, which, you know, people have talked about forever. And I think that, you know, the great thing is we know this. The bad thing is I think that this whole idea that, you know, oh, I can program my subconscious leads to a lot of mental masturbation, you know, of people like sitting around and, you know, watching The Secret and like, you know, staring at their vision boards thinking that, hey, you know, this is all just going to magically fall into my lap now that I'm doing this. And I mean, you and I both know that's not the truth. So when you think about the subconscious from that perspective, then how do you actually change it in a way that's realistic?
Yeah. It is such a fascinating subject, the subconscious. How I look at it and kind of how I framed it in the book, and I do think it makes it more realistic, is that it really has a lot to do with your emotional level as a person. You know, you as a person are an emotional being. You know, our physical body, a lot of people think that the body is actually comprised of emotions. Like there's a book by a lady named Candace Pert called The Body is the Subconscious Mind. And she also wrote another book called Molecules of Emotion. But a lot of people actually think that like the body, like emotions are actually physical, you know, which is why I think we feel them so powerfully. And that emotions are the things that relay information throughout our body. And so, for example, we act unconsciously all the time. Actually, they say that we act 90% of the time or more unconsciously on autopilot. So like, here's a really tangible example. You're driving, you hit a stoplight, you pull out your phone and look at it because you're at the stoplight. You didn't necessarily do that consciously. You actually probably did that unconsciously. You know, we get so addicted to various things that we just do them habitually. Habits and unconscious are very connected, but what drives habits is actually emotions. It's the emotions. The habit is to produce the emotion. So pulling out your phone without thinking about it gives you a dopamine hit. And dopamine is a chemical that gets released throughout your body. And so really, the reason we act unconsciously is because our body becomes accustomed to an emotional climate or levels of emotions. You know, if you need a lot of dopamine, for example, because your body's gotten so addicted to that state, then you're probably going to do a lot of things to produce dopamine. You know, sometimes you could be addicted to stress, you know what I mean? Or whatever it may be. The point is we engage in behaviors to produce emotions. And if you want to upgrade or change your subconscious, you've got to kind of do it. You're kind of resetting a lot of things. Like, that's why I really recommend going outside the comfort zone and engaging in new and intentional behaviors, is because it kind of resets the emotional climate rather than just acting unconsciously and being driven by whatever emotions are currently fueling you. You're actually seeking new experiences, which kind of reset that. It's not just emotions. I mean, it's also, it has a lot to do with just how you see the world. It has a lot to do with your identity and your beliefs and stuff. But you can systematically change at the subconscious level. Like, how I look at it at the really basic, simple level is behaviors and experiences. Behaviors and experiences are what change your subconscious. Like, I gave a speech in somewhere in England, I don't know, like a year and a half ago. And I just decided to look up really nice restaurants just for fun. I was just there by myself, didn't have my kids. And I just decided to look up like Michelin star restaurants. I got paid a good amount of money to give the speech. And I'm like, I'm just going to drop like $500. Like, I don't do that very much. No, it's like, I'm not throwing money at junk, but like, I'm just like, I'm going to go just do this. And so I went to this extremely nice restaurant by myself and I just sat there. I had my journal with me and I was just observing the situation. And I just ordered whatever and I let someone bring me food. And I was, and the idea came to my mind of subconscious enhancing experience. Just being in a situation that to some degree exposes you to something different than you're typically exposed to. You know, so in the book, in the section on exposure, I talk about Charlie Trotter and about how Charlie Trotter owned a famous restaurant back in the 90s that like Oprah and other people recommended. But Charlie would bring like homeless kids into the restaurant and expose them to just a radically different experience. So that's like why they say that experiences, you know, can lead you to never going back. They become point of no returns because they stretch you, you know. But Charlie was exposing these kids to something new, not to make them sad about their current situation, but to expose them to some different possibility. And so experiences can kind of reshape your sense of what's possible or even what's normal. And then behaviors can do the same thing. Like right now, all of us, our unconscious is kind of what I would call your current self. Whatever you do on a daily basis, your just regular pattern, the thing you do on autopilot to some degree, whatever is just current you, is basically your subconscious. If you had a different future self that was at a higher level or at a different level or doing something totally different, you know, like the unconscious Ben Hardy in 2015 didn't like parenting. It created a lot of bad emotions for Ben Hardy. That's why he stayed away and he went back to school and he didn't want to go home, is because at the unconscious level, Ben Hardy didn't like that. You know, he wanted to in his head. But it took me like working at it and investing in it and, you know, building better meanings around it. And ultimately a lot of trial and error and a lot of hard days to unconsciously love it and for it to become a part of my identity. And you have to kind of invest yourself in it and actually genuinely want it and fuel that desire and give a reason for that and go through the ups and downs of learning, kind of like my daughters. Unconsciously, they could not swim 4 months ago and they hated it. Now, unconsciously, they love it. There's a lot of positive emotion connected to it, but they went through a lot of freaking hard learning to get there, a lot of experiences. And so that's kind of how I look at the unconscious, is it gets shaped through experiences and behaviors. And if you consistently start acting in a new way, your unconscious is going to follow suit. If you consistently put yourself in new environments and expose yourself to new experiences, your sense of what's normal or what's real shifts, and what becomes unconscious or just what we could call the new norm to your future self may be completely unfathomable, maybe even undesirable to your current self.
Wow. Dude, like I said, this is a really deep rabbit hole.
It is, dude. It's a great rabbit hole though, right?
Yeah, it really is. Well, this has been fantastic. I mean, I think you've given people a lot to think about. So I want to finish with my final question, which I know you've heard me ask. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think the thing that, in my opinion, makes something unmistakable is probably just that they're just being as honest and real as they possibly can in that situation. You know what I mean? Like they're just being, they're not being reactive. They're not doing something you think that they want you to do. They're just doing what they genuinely believe they could or should or want to be doing in that moment. You know, like, yeah, I mean, it's just, it's easy to be encumbered by internal and external obstacles, whatever those may be, you know, your own fears, your own imposter syndrome, your own fixed mindset, your own trauma, or external, the worries about what other people think, or mm-hmm. legitimately a tough environment. And I think that unmistakable from my perspective, is transcending both of those things to the best you can. And whatever that looks like for that given person in that given situation, to me, that's unmistakable.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your wisdom and your insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and the new book?
Yeah, man. Well, first off, thank you, man. I definitely really appreciate you and your work and appreciate your patience getting me on this show. BenjaminHardy.com is my website. You could get a free future self checklist there and get access to a free 23-minute training where I break down the best science from personality isn't permanent. And my invitation would be just check out this book. This book is thick. It's deep. There's about 150 journal prompts for reframing trauma, for designing your future self. I bust a lot of myths in this book about personality. And I think I explain things in this book that maybe they've been explained, maybe they haven't, but I think that this book will surprise you in a way that maybe you haven't been surprised by a book in this genre for a while. Hmm.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this, AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys and download your free copy.